I want to explore two ways that Jews have responded to crisis, and I would like to use the backdrop of Yosef and his brothers together with Hanukkah to help us understand how we respond to crisis, how we should respond to crisis, and what Hashem expects of us. If you look in Parashat Vayeshev, Perek Lamitet Pasuk Chaf, we are at the end of the Parsha, only the beginning, or maybe we'll say the middle of the story of Yosef and his brothers. Vayikach Adonai Yosef Oto. Vayitnehu El Beit HaSohar Mekom Asher Asirei HaMelech Asurim Vayihisham Beveit HaSohar. Where is Yosef? In jail. How do you say jail?
Beit HaSohar.
Chaf Aleph. Vayihi Hashem et Yosef. Vayit alav chesed. Chesed. Vayitain chino ba'inei sar. Beit HaSohar. Where is the sar? The Beit HaSohar. Where is Yosef? Beit HaSohar. Chaf Bet. Vayitain sar Beit HaSohar. Beyad Yosef. Eit kol ha'asirim asher. Beveit HaSohar. Veit kol asher osim sham hu haya oseh. Where's Yosef? Any questions as to where Yosef is?
No.
Couldn't the Chumash have said, oh, thank you very much. Couldn't the Torah have said, Vayitain hasar biyad Yosef? Or couldn't the Torah have said, Vayitain chino beinei hasar? The Torah has given us so far 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it's 5 reminders where Yosef is. Yosef is Beveit HaSohar, in jail. Chaf Gimel. Ein sar Beit HaSohar ro'eh et kol mi'uma biyado ba'asher Hashem ito va'asher hu oseh Hashem matzliach. I'm saying it again because the Torah said it again. Where's Yosef? Beit HaSohar. Take a look at Perek Mem. Pasuk Aleph. Vayehi acharat v'rayim ha'elech hatu mashkei melech mitzrayim ve'aufel la'adonaihem le'melech mitzrayim. Vayiktov paro al shnei sarisav al sara mashkim v'al sara ofim. Vayitein otam b'mishmar beit sara tabachim el beit ha'sohar. Mekom asher Yosef asur sham. Where's Yosef? Beit HaSohar, where's the Sara Mashkim? Beit HaSohar, where's the Sara Ofim? Beit HaSohar, everyone okay? The story continues. They have a dream. Forward that changed world history. Madua Pnechem Ra'im Ayom. Remember that? Amazing. Finally, Paro is reminded. 2 years later, he's reminded that there is this Na'ar Ivri Eved who was with me in jail. And Perek Mem Aleph Pasuk Yudalid. Vayishlach Paro Vayikra et Yosef Vayiritzuhu min Beit HaSohar Vayigalav Vayichalev Sim Lotav. That is not what the Torah said. Those of you looking inside know that I did not read the Pasuk properly. The Torah, after telling me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times that where was Yosef? In the Beit HaSohar. Vayishlach Memalef Yudalid. Vayishlach Paro. Vayikra et Yosef. Vayiritzuhu min Habor. What bor? He's not in the bor. What bor are we talking about? The boar we're talking about brings us all the way back to Perek Lamed Zayin in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev. Yosef, no matter what happened to him over the last years, 2 years plus, Yosef, no matter where he was physically, psychologically, he was still in the boar. He was still figuring out and working out Vayiritsuhu min Habor. As a matter of fact, the only time in the Chumash between the story of Yosef in Lamed Zayin being thrown into the boar, and between the time that Yosef is Vayiritsu min Habor, the only time the Tanakh mentions the word boar is the one time when in Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Yud Dalet, Pasuk Tet Vav, I'm sorry, it's not Lamed Zayin, it's Perek Mem. Mem Tet Vav. The only time the word boar is mentioned at all is when Yosef unburdens himself to the Sarah Mashkim, and he says, Ki guno gunavti me eretz ha'ivrim v'gam po lo asiti me'uma ki samu oti babor. Yosef was still in the boar. One way that Jews react to crisis is by living in the past, by living with that crisis, believing in God, davening to Hashem, but waiting for a miracle. Vayiritsuhu min Habor. Now it is true that Yosef tried to get himself out. Remember me, Sarah Mashkim. But one way, and this we're going to be talking about two ways that Jews respond to crisis. One way is Vayiritsuhu min Habor, is by living in the past, by being unable to unburden ourselves by what happened in the past. Yosef was not in the boar. He was in the Beit HaSoar. The Torah told me that 7 times. And yet, Vayiritsuhu min Habor. I think that this first way of being stuck in the past, by being unable to fly because you have weights from your past on your ankles, one way that is alluded to in Perek Lamed of Tehillim. Perek Lamed of Tehillim is a mizmor that you and I say all the time, every single day. It's mizmor shir Chanukat Habayit LeDavid. According to the Vilna Gaon, on Chanukah, you don't say, and remember that Parshiot, Vayeshev, and Miketz are always, Vayeshev is always before Chanukah. Miketz is either almost always on Chanukah or right before Chanukah. And the Vilna Gaon says that on Chanukah, you don't say the Shir Shel Yom for Sunday. I did not say today Hayom Yom Rishon B'Shabbat and say the Shir for Sunday. And tomorrow I don't say for Monday. Our shul follows Minag Agra. The Gra says that Mizmor Lamed of Tehillim, Mizmor Shir Chanukat Habayit LeDavid, is what we say every day of Chanukah. The Vilna Gaon has his own system of Shir Shel Yom, and our shul and many shuls in Israel follow the Vilna Gaon. And I think this idea of being a little bit stuck in the past and relying on Hashem to get us out, and we do rely on Hashem, I think it's alluded to in this mizmor. So take a look in Lamed if you have it in front of you, fine. If not, I'll read it out loud. Mizmor Shir Chanukat Habayit LeDavid, I'm skipping. Hashem, Dalid. Elita min Sheol Nafshi. You've taken me out of Sheol, the depths. Chitani Miyardivor. You have made me live and have gotten me out of my own boar. Kirega biapo in Vav. Kirega biapo Chayim birtzono. Ba'erev yalin bechi velaboker rina. Sometimes we need Hashem to get us out of the past, similar to Yosef. But I think that there is another way that we can and must relate to crisis, also related to Mizmor Lamed, and also related to Hanukkah. You can imagine, you're sitting at home, sitting at the Shabbos table, and you notice that there is a crack, a little crack, in your wall, in your dining room. It's a little crack. So you do what most smart people do. You take a picture and you put it on top of the crack. And then a few weeks later, you notice that the crack is kind of growing outside of the picture. So you do what most smart people do, is you get a bigger picture, or you turn it sideways, or you paint over it, and you forget about it. And then it gets bigger, and then it gets bigger, and finally you have no choice. But you go and you call a handy person, and the handy person comes in and looks at the crack and says, "You're so lucky that you called me now and you didn't try to keep painting over it, because this handy person says, this is a retaining, this is a support wall. Your house, you know, some walls are support walls and some walls are not. Your house rests on this wall. And if you had waited for too long, the crack would have endangered your life and literally caused your house to crumble. At the very least, I can fix this now for 1,000 shekel. Had you waited for the crack to get bigger, wider, longer, it wouldn't cost you 1,000 shekel, it would cost you 100,000 shekel or 500,000 shekel to redo the whole house because of the crack." And you say to this person, "Don't worry about it, just put some spackle in it, paint over it, I have the paint in my garage to say." And the person says, "I don't think you heard what I said. I can paint over it. It'll be fine. You're not in danger this minute." But if you don't address this crack, if you don't address this fissure head on, take the blow, spend the 1,000 shekel, be inconvenienced, go through the discomfort, your house will crumble, things will get worse. This is a second way to address a crisis. Open your Chumashim to Perek Membet. We know that Yaakov mourned for Yosef for 22 years. And the Torah told us in Vayeshev, at the end of Vayeshev, the Torah told us, "Vayakumu kol banav, kol benotav, lenachamo." I'm at the end of Vayeshev. I'm not yet at Membet, I'm sorry. And what does the Torah tell us? Two words. Vayimain lehitnachem. Yaakov refused to be consoled. And Rashi says, because a person can only accept consolation on the dead. Psychologists call this closure. Rachman alitzlan, we don't wish this upon anyone in the world. But when we have a missing soldier, sometimes, it is better to hear that the soldier has died. And the family can grieve, and the family can eventually go through the stages of grief, as you probably know, and eventually getting to acceptance. Yaakov was not prepared to accept Yosef's death. Why not? His brothers, my other sons tried to kill my son. Impossible. And besides, there's evidence. There's ketonet pasim. There's blood all over. He's dead. Because Yosef knew. I'm sorry, Yaakov knew that there was a crack in the family. This crack, something's not right. Something's not right. And there is this crack. And it is getting bigger. And it is getting bigger. And it is getting wider. And it is getting thicker. And says Yaakov, if I don't address this crack head on, it's going to tear my family apart. And so we turn to Perek Membet, Pasuk Aleph, in this coming week's Parsha. There's a famine going on, but in Egypt, the Torah tells us, Vayar Yaakov, ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim. The word shever in Hebrew means two things. It means a crack. It means smashed. It means broken. It means a crisis. In modern Hebrew, a crisis is a mashber. A mashber is a crisis, a crack, a break, torn. But that's not only what it means. Vayar Yaakov ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim. Shever means food. Shever means, in this context, life. You approach the shever head on, and you receive shever back. Keep looking. By the way, why only Yaakov? The whole world didn't know that there was shever b'mitzrayim? Why doesn't it say Vayishma Yaakov? And many Mefarshim talk about the difference between Vayar and Vayishma. Vayar. He saw the crack. He saw the mashber. But he knew that there was shever. Vayomer pasuk bet, hine shamati ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim. Radu shama v'shivru lanu misham v'nichye v'lo namut. When you have a crisis, you could live in the past. You can live in your own pit. But you can also address the crack head on. You can address the mashber head on. And it's not only that. Gimel vayerdu achei Yosef asara lishbor bar mimitzrayim. Hey, vayavou b'nei Yisrael lishbor b'toch habayim. Pasuk Vav, V'Yosef hu ha-shalit al ha-aretz hu ha-mashbir. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. When you hear about the crack in the wall, you are upset. What a pain, I have to spend 1,000 shekel. But you are also grateful that you caught it now. Yaakov said, this mashbir is not going to continue. We are going to face it head on. We're not solving it here in Eretz Canaan. There's shever, there's food, there's life. V'nichye v'lo namut. We're going to look, we're not going to put a picture over this crack anymore. We are going to approach the shever and get shever in return. I think we allude to this kind of crisis, or this reaction to crisis, we allude to that also in Perek Lamed in Tehillim. Go back, Mizmor Shir Chanukata Bayit LeDavid, Pasuk Bet, Aromimcha Hashem Ki Tilitani Velo Simachta Oyveli. Says Rav Hirsch, the word Tilitani comes from the word dli. What does dli mean? Yafeme, oh, the pail or a bucket. What do you do with a bucket? You throw it down into the well. You throw it down into the dark and the loneliness. Low, low, low. And yet, what happens to the bucket? Down there, is where it gets filled up. A dli also comes from the word dal. Who's a dal? A poor person, yafeh me'od. Someone who is in the lowest of the low. But we know, by the end of the Mizmor Pasuk Yudbet, Hafachta mispedi lemacholi pitachta sakiva tazreini simcha, you take the actual hesped and turn it into a machol, a dance, a celebration. You take the shever and turn it into shever. You take the sack, and not just run away from the sack, but using the sack, v'tazreini simcha. I get simcha literally from being thrown down into the well. I get simcha looking at the shever and receiving shever in return. It is a second way. It's a second way that we react to crisis. One way is living in the past. Excuse me. And that's extremely dangerous. It's normal in the very beginning of crisis, but it is not a long-term solution. The longer-term solution is taking that very thing that we recognize is a problem, and we turn that into success. I know a few minutes ago you heard a beautiful idea from Rav Yitzchak Huttner. I want to share with another idea for 60 seconds. He shares it on Hanukkah, but like all Torah, it is a 365 day a year Dvar Torah. We know that on Hanukkah, because of the miracle or miracles, we say, says the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat Daf Chaf Aleph, and we say it in our own Ala Nisim, that these are days of Hoda'a V'Simcha. These are days of incredible gratitude. And says Rav Yitzchak Huttner, a very fascinating idea. This is really a sicha about language. Until I want to end with a story, a personal story, but before I do that, says Rav Yitzchak Huttner, the word modeh means gratitude. Todah rabah. Modi manachnu lach. Modeh ani lefanecha melechai v'kayam. It means, I thank, I express gratitude. Says Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner in Pachad Yitzchak on Hanukkah, modeh also means something completely different. What does modeh mean? If we say it in the Gemara all the time, I admit, if you say, Rabbi, you owe me 100 shekel, and I say, ani modeh, it means I admit that I owe you 100 shekel. Or, if I say, I owe you 50, the Gemara calls that modeh b'miktzat. I admit. So we have two meanings. One means thank you, and one means I admit. Says Rav Huttner, of course there are not two meanings. Of course there's one meaning. When I say thank you to you, or when I say thank you to Hashem, the only way I can truly say thank you is if and when I admit that I couldn't do it by myself. When I admit that I need you. When I admit that there's nothing that I could have done by myself. And believe me, we try. We try to not bring God into the equation. We try, remember the story of the parking spot? You've heard it a lot of times this year already. I don't need God. I'll find a parking space myself. I don't need God. I'll go to a doctor. I don't need God. And I have an army. I don't need God. That's not called thank you. Thanking somebody else and thanking God first is a recognition, I admit. I need you. And so these messages, reactions in the Yosef story, the reactions in your life and in my life are also reactions that happen on Hanukkah. Everything will be fine. The Greeks are coming. They've got a nice idea. It's very beautiful messages. Nothing wrong with sports. God likes sports. Nothing wrong with the Olympics. Very beautiful. Until we recognize and admit that we can't fight this battle ourselves. We work. We have ishtadlut. We also have to address this crisis head on. That's part one of what I wanted to share. The idea of Hanukkah shining light on the world. But before we do that, we have to shine light on ourselves and inside ourselves. I have something to share, but I can't do it without God. I have talents, but I have nothing without God. I do go to the doctor. I do have a police force. I do have an army. But they are all shlichim of HaKadosh Baruch. And that's the way I want to transition into a story that I have told. I don't want to exaggerate, but I think I've told it every year to family, friends, or students, and or students, every year, at least for the last 30 years. So in order not to break my streak, I'd like to share a story with you, a personal story about when I was in the army on Hanukkah. I'll tell it kind of quickly. We are followed after this by an incredible shiur by Rabbi David Aaron, phenomenal author of many Sfarim, Rosh Yeshiva, Kabbalist. I mean, just an incredible, incredibly dynamic person. We'll record it, and if he lets us publicize it, we will. Maybe speaking about some things that are not recordable, if you know what I mean. Sometimes you can give a shiur on Kabbalah, and then the shiur comes out blank. I'm just kidding, but that might be true. Okay. I'm young at heart. I still drink orange soda, but I was drafted into the Army in June of 1987. And I had about 6 months of basic training. I was in a tank unit. I became a tank gunner. I was the guy inside the tank in charge of the main cannon. On Yom HaTzma'ut, Hashem should bless me. Hopefully I'm able, but I'll bring you to stand on my tank. I have my tank is that I know where it is, and I'll show you where it is, and you can go inside. And My unit was also trained, a specialty unit, to go and accompany other units, such as military engineers, and to burst through certain frontline things like minefields and bridges. And I had the zechut myself, and by the time when basic training was over, I had the zechut myself and two other guys got a certain award at the end of basic training, and the award was very nice and all that. We got, what's the word, promoted in rank, and we also got 3 days vacation that nobody else had. Now, it wasn't really vacation. It doesn't sound to you like vacation, but to us, after coming off of 6 months of really, really hard physically and hard psychological challenges and physical challenges, we were sent, the three of us were sent to a base, and our job was to change the tracks on about 20 tanks. So now that doesn't sound like much of a vacation, but it was a vacation because we could set our own hours, and we could sleep home at night. My family was in America. I have an uncle and an aunt. They should live and be well. They still live here. They live in Ramat Eshkol. And I got to sleep home every night. It was an amazing thing. So, three of us, myself, a guy named Shimon, and a guy named Eli, get sent to this base. And we decided, the three of us, that we are going to kill ourselves for the first day. and change all the tracks. And it's physically difficult. It's a little bit of a pain in the neck. But then we have 2 days vacation. If we're done, we're done. We get to the base. And early. Because we want to really push the first day. And we get there. And they tell us to wait. They're not ready. And we wait, and they wait, and they wait. We would have checked our cell phones for messages, but they weren't invented yet, so we didn't have them to look at them. We wait, and we wait, and there's like a office area in a little trailer on this base, and we keep going, and we're saying, why are you holding us up? And they're not explaining. And it's killing us, because we don't want to come back tomorrow. We wait, we wait. It probably was an hour, but it felt longer. And finally, the woman, the secretary of this base, says, you have a phone call. A phone call. Again, if I'm carrying a cell phone, I have a phone call, it's not so weird. But who knew that we were there? And if whoever knew that we were there didn't know the phone number. And it wasn't me, another guy, I think it was Shimon, if I remember correctly, goes over to the phone and talks, and like, turns out that the night before, there was a terrorist act, brand new in Israel, that this kind of act never happened before. Those of you who have ever been up north near like Ramat Magshimim, on the way to the Hermon, we actually passed it on our tiul up north, we passed this location. A hang glider flew over the Syrian border under the radars of the Israeli radars, landed in Israeli territory, stormed a base by himself, shot some soldiers, and killed one, I believe, before he himself was killed. A terrible thing. But it became clear that he came from Syria and was helped by Syria, or at least we thought. Which meant, and tensions were already very high, end of 1987, tensions were already very high, and we basically thought that we're going to war. And our 3-day vacation, in quotes, was canceled. You must immediately report to a base up north on the Syrian border. The kind of skills that our unit had were needed for the first punch for the war in Syria. Now, you probably know that in 1987, there was no war in Syria. You know that. We didn't know that. Okay, we thought there was going to be a war. They were bringing troops to the border. We were bringing troops to the border. That's what we call a build-up for war. Not only that, but we were told that we had to do something before we got on the bus. In those days, let me back up. Today, if you see a soldier who's working, I don't mean a dress uniform, I mean who's working, most uniforms look very similar to what you see on the streets. But if you are in tanks, you won't see it on the streets. They wear a full body, it looks like a mechanic's jumpsuit? Jumpsuit?
Yeah. Yeah.
They call it jumpsuit? Full body. And they wear, when they're inside the tank itself, not only the full body suit, they also wear gloves. So today, it doesn't sound so bad. Come back in August and sit inside a tank with a full body suit and gloves and a full mask. All, you know, covering your whole head. The only thing that's open is a mask, very hot. That's what they wear today. In those days, we never wore them. We only tried them on once to make sure they fit. They fit, good. Roll them up, put inside a sealed bag, and you take them out only in war. The reason is, these suits are fiberglass. They can sit inside a burning tank for 9 seconds. Maybe it's more today. In those days, it was 9 seconds. So we trained over and over and over and over, evacuating a tank within 9 seconds. Very hard in the beginning. Because you only had 9 seconds. And they scared us that we had to wear these all the time. They showed a picture of a man, I remember, when they were teaching us to put these on, because they're uncomfortable and they're hot. He showed a picture of a man, Chas Rachmana Litzlan, who he was wearing like a tank top and shorts. His body looked perfect, except he had a circle like this on his face, third degree burns, because he wore his suit, but he didn't wear his mask. Fire happened inside the tank. He burned his entire face, and everything else, literally a line, was completely fine. That scared us. So today, I think they wear them all the time. In those days, we wore them once, except in wartime. And we were told in wartime, you break them out and you put them on. Well, the same phone call that told us that we're going up to the Syrian border, they told us, before you get on the bus, tear open the suits and put them on. That anybody who tells you they weren't scared is either stupid or lying. We were going to war, no question. And we were on the front lines of that war. And it's petrifying. Lo aleinu, lo aleinu. We get on the bus and we drive up to the border. And we get to this. If we were talking in Chutz La'aretz, I would have said a godforsaken base. But there is no godforsaken base or anywhere in Israel. So it was in the geometric center of nowhere. Okay? It was in the middle of nowhere. We were 3 kilometers, a little more than a mile, off of the Syrian border. We could see the Syrian guards. We used to give them names because we could recognize that one with the mustache and that one with the beard. They had a dog on their base. We gave the dog a name. That's how close we were. At night, we were on full darkness. Full darkness. Anybody who was foolish enough to smoke wasn't allowed to smoke outside. Your whole body had to be camouflaged. Dog tags inside your shirt. Any buttons, watches had to be covered. No flashlights. Pitch black. And we were on guard duty, double duty. 2 people per spot instead of 1. And we were on the highest alert possible, which meant no matter what, if you were eating, davening, using the facilities, sleeping, your entire base had to be in a moving tank in 2 minutes. Okay? Imagine you're sleeping, you have to get into full body gear, full battle gear, onto a tank in time to turn the tank on and moving within 2 minutes. And not only that, but they did drills all the time. A, for us, to remind ourselves that we were on call and practice, and definitely to show the Syrians that we mean business. It was tense. It was scary. Guys once in a while got into stupid fights, even though you were with them forever, but because the tension was really high. At night, pitch black. Sleeping less. Terrible. We were so distant that the supply truck only came once a week. Once a week they would come, they would bring us food for the week, they would also climb up. We had a water tower, and one of us, I did it once or twice, climb up this water tower. I guess it was about 1.5 stories high, 2 stories high, with a big hose. You fill it up with water, and then gravity brings the water to the rest of the base once a week. Ration out the food once a week. And that's how we lived for a while. And Hanukkah was approaching. And we realized that we didn't have Chanukiot. We had candles. It's part of our battle gear. We have matches. Part of our battle gear. We didn't have Chanukiot. Halachically, you don't need. Halachically, you could use cups. You could melt it onto tinfoil. but it was certainly, it took away. Morale was already amazing and ready. If you're ready to fight, you fight. If you're ready to fight and you wait, it was hard and hard and hard. We didn't have. And we had to wait a few days to get a Hanukkiah. Hanukkah was coming. What do we do? So we did two things, and I want to share with you both of them, and with this I'll end. The first thing we did, and this was the highest ranking officer on this base, 40 guys, let us do the following. Remember, it was supposed to be pitch black at night. Any lights were underground. We had a bunker, an underground bunker. That's all we were allowed to use, lights and all that. But outdoors at night, pitch black. And this lieutenant, two bars over here, he said, the morale is so low. I take that back. It wasn't so low. Things were tense, that this is what we're going to do. When you're in a tank, so I told you that I was the gunner. So I was in charge of a few small machine guns that were connected to the, and my own. But the main cannon, when you shot the shell, so this torpedo, like this size, maybe this size, flies 4, 5, 6 kilometers. But this, it's also called a shell. This like long cylinder, you familiar with that? This long cylinder gets shot out. It's inside the tank, it gets shot out. We have to save them, at least we had to in those days, because they were recycling, recyclable. The Israeli army, it doesn't have all the money in the world. So first of all, when it comes out, you have to put it away. And it's the loader's job not only to load this big shell in, but also after it shoots, it gets popped out. Now you have this empty shell, big cylinder with an opening on top. It shot out, he has to put it away, or else it's going to get mixed up in the moving parts and mess up things. He commanded us to take 9 shells and climb to the top of this water tower and tie them to the water tower and face the Syrian army and fill it with sand and fill it with gasoline. We're a tank unit, we've got a lot of gasoline. Fill it with kerosene. We took an old uniforms, ripped them up, and used these huge shells and these uniforms as wicks. And we lit one night and two nights. We almost burned the water tower down. The lieutenant almost got arrested for breaking protocol. A person was not allowed to smoke. And we lit up the night. And not only did we do that, we danced around the bottom of the water tower. Yevanim, Yevanim, nikbetzu alai. The Syrian Greeks, 2,000 years ago, more, tried to change us, tried to destroy us, and here we were with Tzahal on our uniforms, telling them, we are still here. And we lit up the night, we are still here. Your ancestors tried to destroy us, and they failed, and you'll fail also. And it was, I've heard this story many times, and I was there, and I myself, CW, because I still remember the exhilaration that we felt. Our ancestors fought against your ancestors, and if need be, we will fight against you. But it's not just going to be us against you, it's going to be us plus God against you, and there's no way you can win. Night one, night two, night three, awesome. However, we did not fulfill the mitzvah. It was too tall. They were too close together. The wicks were not wicks. They were torches. So we had an amazing time. We didn't fulfill the mitzvah. I don't have a Chanukiah. What am I supposed to do? Somebody, I don't think it was me, had the idea to do the exact same thing in our bunker. Now, I can't use a huge shell. But I told you that one of the guns that I was in charge of is a gun that's parallel to the main gun. It's called a mag. In English, it's called a mag. and it's a pretty big bullets like this, and they're shot out. Now you may have seen this, but the bullets load into the gun in a chain. Have you ever seen bullets on a chain? And they literally are fed in to the gun, shot out, and the little shells, same as the big ones, get shot out the other side, together with the links that link the bullets. Are you following? So you have bullets with links. As they're shot out, the shells come out the other end, the little links come out the other end, they're collected, they're recycled, they were at least in those days, and we took them. And I will tell you that when I think about my days in the Army, I don't just have visual memories, I actually have olfactory memories. I can smell still today the smell of gunpowder inside the tank. I also have audio memories. Is that what it's called? Because audio? Auditory memories. Thank you. Auditory memories. Because when you hear a gun, I, inside the tank, also hear the tinkling, the little tinkling of the shells coming out the other end. And we took them. And we, inside our bunker, we couldn't do it outside anymore, inside our bunker, little shells, we collected them. The bullets are gone, but the empty shells are there. We linked them together, and we made Chanukiyot. And again, we sang inside, and again we said, you think that you can beat us, you cannot. The difference between the first story of the shells on the water tower and between the story of the little shells, A, we were Yotze the second time, we're not Yotze the first time. The second difference is that I don't have the huge shells anymore. But I do have the menorah that I lit with and I brought it with me today. And I want to show you the menorah that we lit with. This is the menorah that we lit. Now, you may notice that in those days we celebrated 16 days of Hanukkah. Actually, it's not true. But we, on the second night, we noticed that the candles were too close together. They melt each other. So we put an extra one in between to separate them. And as a matter of fact, on purpose, I have never cleaned it out. This is still the wax that I used. This is the Chanukiah that we spent, that we lit. I told the story to an elementary school class, and there was a grandmother in the room who was a curator for the Jewish Museum in New York, Upper West Side, and she asked me if I would ever think of donating it to the museum. I said I would think about it, but I'm not that selfless yet. I wanted to keep it for myself and for my family, and it is literally a reminder for me. I bring it out every year. It's a reminder for me not only of times when I thought we were going to go to war, but it was a time where the story of Hanukkah literally boosted my spirits and everybody else's spirits to remind ourselves. And ladies, today, anybody who saw the news last night knows that we really need a Hanukkah. We really need a Hanukkah now. The world, to say the very least, does not always appreciate the Hanukkah miracle like you and I do. And the world sometimes points their fingers at us and say, you don't belong in this country. You don't belong, you don't deserve to hope for a Chanukat HaMizbeach. You don't deserve to wait for Mashiach. The gall of somebody to wish us a happy Hanukkah, the same person who says, the story of Hanukkah happened at your temple, which never existed, on an area that you shouldn't live on, that must belong to the Palestinians. The chutzpah brings new meaning to the word. And sometimes we need a reminder that it's not us against the world. It's us plus Hashem against the world. And with those odds, we will surely win. Emir Tz Hashem. Have a happy Hanukkah, everybody.